welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May the 8th, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. And today in eastern Iowa, we'll have partly cloudy skies. It'll be a windy day with winds from the north at 15 to 30 miles an hour. Cedar Rapids will have a high of 51 today and a low of 29 tonight. We'll enjoy 14 hours and 19 minutes of daylight today, with sunset tonight at 8:13 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 5:53 a.m. Today's top story in the Gazette, virus shuts down Iowa Writers' House for now. This is a story by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. Once upon a time, there was a house in a city that loved literature. It was a quaint two-story home in the heart of the historic district with brick stairs, pale yellow siding, a hipped red roof, and a rich history. Its original owner was Emma J. Harvat, who in 1922 became the nation's first female mayor for a city of more than 10,000 people. Nearly a century later, in 2014, Andrea Wilson was working in advertising in Florida and pined for a more so-called altruistic purpose for her life. So she planned a return to Iowa, where she grew up in Columbus Junction. But this time, Wilson would live in Iowa City, known for, among other things, pioneering academic creative writing pursuits at the University of Iowa's famed Writers' Workshop. Wilson wanted to write and found the idea of the historic Harvat House so charming, she bought it, quote, sight unseen, from down in Miami, aiming to run it as a bed and breakfast. But when she arrived, Wilson discovered a need in her new community she aimed to fill. It had a surprising dearth of literary resources for those outside the university. Quote, there wasn't any place for the public to take a class or meet other writers or really be part of a writing community where people could just express their humanity through words, she said. It became my passion project to try to create that for this community. I thought if anywhere should have a place like that, it would be America's only UNESCO City of Literature at the time, end quote. So in March 2015, Wilson debuted Iowa City's first community-based literary center for writers, or those aspiring. She had hoped to open a communal writing space closer to downtown, but didn't have the funding. So she gave her home a third identity, the Iowa Writers' House. She continued to live there and maintain her bed and breakfast business, which funded the writing endeavor and kept its cozy corridors bustling with interesting characters. Famed visiting writers included Leslie Jameson, American novelist and essayist with works on the New York Times bestseller list, Hope Edelman, whose 6 nonfiction books have published in 17 countries and translated in 11 languages, Alison Bechdel, an American cartoonist and MacArthur Fellow, and Piedad Bonet Velez, Colombian poet, playwright, and novelist of international acclaim. And over the years, the Iowa Writers' House connected, served, and motivated thousands with its workshops, seminars, readings, and summer camps. It offered editing services, founded a bicultural Iowa Writers' Fellowship, and among other things, inspired a growing network of friends and creatives to value their own stories and the stories of others. Quote, I said yes to everything anyone ever asked of me, Wilson said. We gave tours. I received visiting scholars. We hosted dinners for visiting poets and writers for the university, and a lot of that was all volunteer. We never had a steady funding stream like most literary centers do, end quote. So when the coronavirus in March reached Iowa City, later shuttering storefronts, canceling events, curtailing travel plans, and crippling the economy, the Iowa Writers' House momentum stopped too. Quote, once COVID hit, because of all our programming is live and people come to the house, we had to cancel it, Wilson said. She dropped most of the organization's spring season. She lost all her projected bed and breakfast business. And in a message posted to the Iowa Writers' House website last month, Wilson announced her hard but unavoidable news. Quote, as the situation pushes on, and with no programming in the foreseeable future, we must make drastic changes, she wrote. Organizations must weather the storm or adapt, and in the case of this little organization with a big heart, evolution is the only option, end quote. And so, after 5 years of intimate conversations, communal meals, singing, laughing, crying, and lots of writing and reading, all done in the shadow of Harvat, the organization is leaving the historic space and, quote, taking a break to assess our mission and consider our best options for the future, end quote. Wilson said she plans to focus on her own writing, and the Bicultural Iowa Writers Fellowship Program will continue, allowing for the release later this year of a third volume of We Are the Interwoven, an anthology of bicultural Iowa, including six new authors with multilingual stories of living in Iowa. News of the goodbye, at least for now, has been met with an outpouring of support and testimonials of the impact the Iowa Writers' House has had. Quote, I grew up without a writing community, and it was a very lonely experience, Aaron Casey wrote to Wilson after learning of its pause. Casey, on the Iowa Writers' House team and director of the Writers' Rooms, an offshoot of the house, said her involvement in the project shaped not only her career, but her personal growth. Quote, you and the Iowa Writers' House helped me become a stronger person who felt deserving of companionship, respect, and love, she wrote. Watching the house grow, the workshops fill, and the stories come in about how much the IWH touched people's lives added to the joy. I finally found a place to call home, end quote. Casey said that while the future is unknown, its legacy is not. Quote, the IWH will live on in the hearts of the people you touched, she wrote. Writers have found friends, support, guidance, end quote. Although the project isn't getting a fairy tale ending, Wilson said the story isn't over. Quote, the organization is leaving the space. I'm leaving the space. We're going on an organizational break so we can determine what a sustainable future might be, she said. Quote, but it's really the end of a chapter, and we don't know what the next chapter will be, end quote. And in another front-page story compiled by the Gazette staff, men and elderly lag in taking assessment. Nearly 327,000 Iowans have taken an assessment to see if they are eligible to be checked for COVID-19 under the Test Iowa initiative. Another free drive-through site for those who have taken the assessment and been scheduled for an appointment opened Thursday in Cedar Rapids, the fourth site in the state so far. About 1 in 46 Iowans have been tested so far, health officials said. State data released Thursday for the first time reveals big gaps in who has and who has not taken the assessment at testiowa.com. Less than 35% of those who have been assessed for tests are men, yet men are more apt to die from the disease than women. Of the 231 Iowa deaths so far, 51% are of men. Secondly, only 2% of those who have been assessed for testing are age 80 or over, but 46% of the Iowa deaths from the virus reported so far are in that age group. And third, there are gaps in the rates at which urban and rural residents are completing the assessment. Nearly 9% of Linn County residents have been assessed, but only about 7.6% of Allamakee County residents have. Yet when looking at the rate of known infection per capita, Allamakee is far worse. And turning to Iowa Today section, Michaela Ram reports, Iowa law blocking sex ed funds ruled unconstitutional. An Iowa judge has ruled unconstitutional a state law that would have blocked Planned Parenthood of the Heartland from receiving federal money to provide sex education programs to Iowa youth. Fifth Judicial District Judge Paul Scott on Wednesday ruled the law, quote, has no valid, realistically conceivable purpose that serves a legitimate government interest as it is both irrationally over-inclusive and under-inclusive, end quote. Quote, the act violates Planned Parenthood of the Heartland's right to equal protection under the law and is therefore unconstitutional, Scott ruled in issuing a permanent injunction to prevent the law's implementation. House File 766, passed in 2019 by the Republican-controlled Iowa House and Senate, excluded any Iowa organization that, quote, provides or promotes abortion, end quote, from receiving federal dollars that support sex education and related services to Iowa youth. Planned Parenthood of the Heartland and ACLU of Iowa challenged the law, filing a lawsuit shortly after Governor Kim Reynolds signed the bill into law. Polk County District Court issued a temporary injunction blocking the law, which was to go into effect July 1st, allowing Planned Parenthood to continue providing sex education programming throughout the past year. The governor's office did not immediately respond to requests for comment on the ruling. In its lawsuit, Planned Parenthood and ACLU argued that by blocking the abortion provider from the two federal grants, the Personal Responsibility Education Program, known as PREP, and the Community Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention, known as CAP, the law violated protections of free speech, due process, and equal protection. Quote, the decision recognizes that the law blocking Planned Parenthood from receiving grants to provide this programming violated the constitutional requirement of equal protection, ACLU of Iowa legal director Rita Bettis Austin said in a statement Thursday. Though Planned Parenthood would be excluded, the law did allow, quote, nonprofit health care delivery systems, end quote, to remain eligible for the federal funding, even if they are contracted with or are affiliated with an entity that performs abortions or maintains a facility where abortions are performed. By doing so, the law effectively singles out Planned Parenthood, but allows other possible grant recipients to provide an array of abortion-related services, according to the court documents. Quote, the carved-out exception for the nonprofit health care delivery system facilities undermines any rationale the state produces of not wanting to be affiliated with or provide funds to organizations that partake in any abortion-related activity, Scott ruled. In fiscal year 2019, Planned Parenthood received about $265,000 through the federal grants, including $85,000 to offer PrEP curriculum in Polk, Pottawatomie, and Woodbury counties. It awarded $182,000 this year to offer CAP curriculum in Linn County, as well as in Dallas, Des Moines, Jasper, Lee, Polk, Plymouth, and Woodbury counties. The grants are administered by the Iowa Department of Human Services and the Iowa Department of Public Health. Planned Parenthood has provided sex education to students in 31 schools and 12 community-based youth organizations in Iowa using state-approved curriculum since 2005, according to a news release. The focus has remained, quote, on areas with the highest rates of unintended pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections, the news release said. Quote, today's decision ensures that teens and young adults across Iowa will continue to have access to medically accurate sex education programs despite the narrow and reckless policies of anti-abortion lawmakers, said Aaron Davison Rippey, executive director of Planned Parenthood North Central States. Also in the Iowa Today section, Vanessa Miller of the Gazette reports, the University of Iowa aims to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half. The University of Iowa on Thursday unveiled new sustainability goals for the next decade that, if accomplished, would cut its greenhouse gas emissions in half from a decade ago and transform the campus into a, quote, living laboratory for sustainability education and exploration, end quote. But the goals fall short of what a collective of Iowa City's so-called climate strikers have demanded for more than a year, that the UI end coal burning immediately at its power plant, commit to using only renewable energy by 2030, and unite with the city of Iowa City in a so-called town gown climate accord. Quote, it's ridiculous for the UI to announce a 2030 climate plan as it continues to burn coal for years and burn methane-spewing natural gas for decades at its power plant, said Massimo Pacciato Biggers, aged 14, a student at Iowa City High and member of the Iowa City Climate Strike Group. The university's new 2030 goals piggyback off its 2020 goals, which former UI President Sally Mason announced in 2010 in hopes of integrating sustainability into the campus's mission. Her goals included consuming less energy on campus in 2020 than in 2010, despite projected growth, diversifying the campus's energy portfolio by using biomass, solar, wind, and the like to achieve 40% renewable energy consumption by 2020, diverting 60% of solid waste, reducing the campus transportation carbon footprint with a 10% cut in per capita transportation and travel, and increasing learning and research opportunities. The university, according to a new report made public Thursday, met or surpassed many of those goals, including, among other things, a slight dip in total energy use, despite 15 new buildings and major additions across campus. The campus also reduced 40% of its energy consumption comes via renewable energy sources, and it reduced annual coal consumption 75%. As for waste production, the university diverted 43% from the landfill and reported diverting 70% more waste than in 2010. In just the first phase, the new 2030 goals, a result of collaboration across campus involving a 2030 UI Sustainability Goal Setting Task Force, involve fewer numbers and hard percentages. Aside from the aim to cut greenhouse emissions by 50% compared to a 2010 baseline, the Phase 1 goals aim to institutionalize and embed sustainability into campus culture, allowing individual units across campus to develop plans to meet campus sustainability goals, expand sustainability research, scholarship, and other unit opportunities, use the campus as a so-called living laboratory capable of improving campus sustainability and ecosystems, prepare students to live and work in the 21st century through sustainability education, and facilitate knowledge exchange among the campus community and with the state, nation, and world. As the campus moves into Phase 2 of its 2030 plan, it will expand on first phase goals by identifying specific and measurable tasks and metrics. Leadership plans to finalize that second phase later in the fall semester. Quote, this approach has meant including units engaged in activities such as academics, research, operations, planning, engagement, athletics, and student life. Stratis Giannakouros, director of the Office of Sustainability and the Environment, said in a statement. Senator Joel Bolcom, a Democrat from Iowa City who serves as Outreach and Community Education Director for the UI Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research, told the Gazette the new goals are, quote, ambitious and forward-looking. The new goals will engage students and research faculty to help build a sustainable path for the campus and broader community, he said. The university recently made big news on the utilities front by entering a $1.165 billion deal with a private French company to operate its utility system for 50 years. The deal nets the utility, the university, a massive upfront lump sum it can invest and pull from annually. It gives the private operator decades of reliable income. And the university, in making the deal, mandated its new provider pursue ambitious sustainability goals, promising to impose penalties if it failed to do so. And Lee Hermiston of the Gazette reports, Lynn Fair cancels entertainment, explores exhibit options for youth. The Lynn County Fair has canceled entertainment in the grandstand and on the fairgrounds this year because of the novel coronavirus and is exploring ways youth can exhibit their work. Quote, after consulting with Lynn County Public Health, the Lynn County Board of Supervisors and other stakeholders, it was determined this was the best decision because of the uncertainty of what the public health situation may look like at the end of June, Lynn County Fair Board President Albert Martin said Thursday in a statement. The fair was scheduled for June 24th through 28th. The Fair Association said in the statement it is working with the Iowa State University Extension and Outreach of Lynn County and Lynn County 4-H to determine how 4-H and FFA members and other youth can exhibit their work. Those details, which could include in-person or virtual exhibiting, are expected to be completed and announced in mid-May. Tom Barnes, executive director of the Association of Iowa Fairs, told the Gazette on Thursday that the Benton County Fair also was canceled for this year. Organizers for the Wapello County Fair in South Central Iowa previously announced they would not host a fair this year. Now let's turn to the insight page of today's Gazette. We'll begin with the Gazette's editorial titled, Who Will Watch the Children? As death rates from COVID-19 rise, the state is beginning to open back up. And with that, the expectation is that Iowans get back to work. Iowans who don't go back to work will lose unemployment benefits, leaving thousands of workers forced to expose themselves and their families to a potentially deadly virus, which experts say could have a second wave in the fall. The rush to reopen the state has left many questions about the health and safety of Iowans unanswered. Among those questions, quote, who will watch the children, end quote, is especially crucial. Schools are closed for the rest of the year. The future of summer camps is uncertain. Half of the child care centers in America currently are closed. Using elderly parents for child care can be risky since grandparents are in the age bracket with the highest risk for death and complications from COVID-19. This leaves families, mothers especially, at risk of losing their jobs and unemployment benefits. Nationwide, women still carry the heavy burden of child care, despite the fact that most families are dual-income homes. Two-thirds of minimum wage workers in America are women, which puts them at risk for unemployment and illness because of exposure to the virus. Already, the child care gap for women contributes to the wage gap. Women earn 80 cents to the male dollar, and the inequality is compounded when segmented by race. Congress has tried to pass a paid leave policy, but those attempts have failed. And Iowa's governor has so far not commented on the looming child care crisis as she declares victory over the virus and opens up the state. Before the pandemic, a quarter of Iowa families lived in a child care desert, and child care in the state does not even come close to meeting the national definition of affordable. Experts estimated that the Iowa economy loses more than $1 billion each year because of a lack of child care. And with the reality of the pandemic sinking in, it will only get worse. The Department of Human Services received $31.9 million in aid from the Federal CARES Act that was dispersed to child care centers to help care for the children of essential workers. But as more people go back to work, that aid will be spent very quickly, leaving the children of everyone else without answers to this fundamental question. If Reynolds wants to open up the state, her team needs to formulate a comprehensive plan that addresses the lack of child care and offers paid leave and works to reopen child care centers. But rushing to open an economy when there is no child care is an attack not just on families, but specifically on mothers. Again, this is a Gazette written by the editors of the Gazette, who can be reached by phone at 319-398-8262 or by email at editorial@thegazette.com. Today's letters to the editor include one written by State Senator Joel Bolcom, titled, A Disaster at Iowa's Meatpacking Plants. Governor Kim Reynolds has put Iowa on the map, and not in a good way. Sioux City and Waterloo-Cedar Falls are now on the list of communities in America with exploding cases of COVID-19. Both communities are now fighting to protect meatpacking workers and the community because company efforts to protect their workers have failed. The alarms started going off at Iowa's meatpacking plant in Tama and Columbus Junction in late March. Packing plants in those communities closed on April 6th due to rampant worker sickness from the deadly virus. Now, after repeated complaints, state OSHA inspectors were finally forced to visit Tyson's plant in Waterloo. Sadly, however, they still have not conducted a single in-person inspection of any other Iowa plants to make sure that workers have protective equipment and are practicing effective infectious disease control. Instead, Governor Reynolds has repeatedly praised company executives for their efforts, trust packing plant CEOs, without independently verifying what they were doing, is now causing sickness, death, and supply chain calamity. Her ideologically motivated decision to block state inspectors from visiting and helping the plants has thrown Iowa livestock farmers into financial and management turmoil. Now the president says all packing plants must remain open. This is a disaster, forcing Iowa workers to work in unsafe conditions without state enforceable protections is cruel and will make all Iowans unsafe while further delaying our economic recovery. Iowans deserve better. Signed, State Senator Joel Bolcom of Iowa City. Today's Gazette Online also includes two columns written by women who are both Democratic candidates for Iowa House District 85. Christina Bohannon's column is titled, Bring New Ideas and Energy to House District 85. The upcoming primary election is a pivotal moment for Iowa City. For the past several months, I have talked to people throughout the district who are ready for change. They believe their Democratic representatives should show up for people throughout the community, especially those in need. They expect a legislator from Iowa's bluest district to be a leader in the party, raising money to support Democratic candidates up and down the ticket and making the strongest possible case for progressive legislation. They are ready to start now in building the future of the Democratic Party and state government in Iowa, and I am honored that they are putting their trust in me. There is a lot at stake in this election. The coronavirus has laid bare and magnified pre-existing inequities, inequities brought about by the legislature's disinvestment in education, health care, and worker rights and safety. Small businesses are now struggling to survive when for years the state has been giving large corporations hundreds of millions of dollars in tax credits. Water quality, climate change, and gun violence still need our attention, even as we continue to invest in keeping people safe from COVID-19. We have never needed strong leadership more than we do now. I will be a champion for progressive values because I have lived them. I know how hard it can be for people to get by, even when they work hard. I grew up in a trailer in rural Florida. Neither of my parents graduated high school. My dad was a construction worker who suffered for years with emphysema. When his health insurance was canceled, my family had to choose between paying for his medicine and everything else. Fortunately, public education gave me the opportunity for a better life. My teachers taught me well and helped me to apply to college. Public university tuition was affordable then, and I was able to work my way through engineering school and law school. Today, I am a law professor, an environmental engineer, and a mother. I believe I have the skills, energy, and passion that Iowa City needs at this critical point in time. I will show up for every member of our community and fight for a better future for all of Iowa. It's time for a change in Iowa City. Please vote for me in House District 85 and help to build the future that Iowa deserves. Again, this column was written by Christina Bohannon, who is a candidate in the Democratic primary for Iowa House District 85. And her opponent in the primary is Vicki Lensing, whose column today is titled Leadership on Education, Funding, Mental Health, and Accessible Voting. Serving as a state representative of House District 85 for the past few years has been a privilege and an honor. I have worked hard to stand for the people of my district, fighting for issues that are important to them and to the voters of Iowa City. I want to continue that advocacy and am running for another term in the Iowa House and ask for your vote. I vigorously support adequate funding for education from preschool to our community, colleges, and universities. Our young people are Iowa's future and deserve the best start available through our excellent education system in Iowa. But we need to provide the dollars necessary to keep our teachers in the classroom so our children are well prepared for whatever may lie ahead of them. I have advocated for the fair treatment of workers in Iowa and support their right to organize. I have worked on laws for equal pay for equal work and whistleblower protection. I am for essential funding for mental health services for Iowans of all ages. Children and adults who are struggling with mental health issues should have services available to them no matter where they live in this state. I have fought to keep government open and accessible to Iowans. I support open records and open meeting laws to ensure that availability and transparency to all Iowans. Keeping voting easy and accessible to voters has been a priority of mine. I support a fair and balanced redistricting system for voting in Iowa. I have advocated to keep the bottle deposit law in place and expand it to cover the many new types of containers available. I have worked on oversight legislation after several investigations into defrauding government, which involved boarding homes, government agencies, and pharmacy benefit managers, the so-called middleman between pharmacies and Medicaid and the healthcare insurance companies. I cannot avoid mentioning the challenge of the coronavirus in Iowa. It has impacted our health, jobs, families, and businesses. No one could have predicted this pandemic, but as Iowans, we need to do our best to limit contact and the spread of this disease. My sincere appreciation goes to those workers on the front line of this crisis, the healthcare workers, store owners, businesses, farmers, teachers, and workers who show up every day to keep this state moving forward. Thank you all. There is still much work to be done to keep Iowa the great place where we live, work, and raise our families. I am asking for your vote to allow me the privilege of continuing that work. This column was written by Vicki Lensing, who is a candidate in the Democratic primary for Iowa House District 85. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May the 8th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Cedar Rapids, Sally Stakeshall, aged 78, died Thursday, May 7th. Arrangements by Bross Chapel and the Avicenture of Cedar Rapids. Manchester, Albert Meister, known as Bert, aged 56, died Wednesday, May 6th. Arrangements by Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. St. Olaf, Leon Hoth, aged 84, died Wednesday, May 6th. Arrangements by Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Alcater. Tipton, Anne E. Hinkhouse, aged 74, died Tuesday, May 5th. Arrangements by Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty. Viral Artis Hansen passed away Wednesday morning, May 6th, 2020. A private family service will be held for Viral at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. She will be buried in Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City beside her mother and father. Arrangements are being handled by Cedar Memorial of Cedar Rapids. Bernadine Caroline McDonald Rushower, known as Bern, aged 86, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Saturday, May 2nd. Private graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, May 9th, at Mount Calvary Catholic Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A funeral mass will be held at a later date. Ken McGrory, aged 61, of Ladora, died May 4th at home of natural causes. A private family graveside service and burial has been scheduled for Saturday, May 9th, at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Victor. A memorial mass will be held at St. Bridget Catholic Church in Victor at a later date. For additional information, please go to the Smith Funeral Home website, www.smithfh.com. Corrine Hatesa Leota Evans, aged 16, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on April 20th. Homegoing services will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, May 17th, at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of Serenity. Timothy James Baranek, aged 60, of Solon, died on Wednesday, May 6th, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Celebration of Life Gathering will be live-streamed from 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday, May 9th, on Brosh Chapel's Facebook page. Friends and family are encouraged to view Leave a Condolence during this time. Private family interment will be at a later date. The Brosh Chapel and the Avicenture are in charge of Jim's arrangements. Elizabeth A. Zoback, known as Betty, passed away unexpectedly on Tuesday, May 5th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldhorf Hospice House of Mercy. She was 92. A memorial service will be held at a later date to be determined. In lieu of funerals, flowers, donations may be made to Dennis and Donna Oldhorf Hospice House in memoriam of Frank and Betty Zoback. Please leave a message or tribute to Betty's family in our webpage, www.cedarmemorial.com. Stanley N. Hauser, aged 87, of Marengo, passed away Tuesday, May 5th, at Rosehaven Nursing Home. A graveside service will be held at noon, Tuesday, May 12th, at Calvary Cemetery in Marengo, with Father David Wilkening officiating. Military honors will be conducted at a later date. A memorial fund has been established in Stanley's name. Closter Funeral Home in Marengo is assisting the family with arrangements. Turning to local sports news in today's Gazette, after one season, Matt Lesson resigns as Solon boys basketball coach. This was his alma mater, a place he had a ton of success at as a player. The future of the program is clearly bright. But Matt Lesson had a clear plan for his own future, which is why he has stepped down as Iowa head boys basketball coach at Solon after just one season. Quote, "It was an incredibly difficult decision," Lesson said late Thursday afternoon, "something that I spent a considerable amount of time thinking about because of the relationships with my kids and the coaching staff. It was a really, really tough decision to move on and look at some opportunities elsewhere," end quote. Lesson, age 31, hopes those opportunities come with the Iowa City Community School District. He has an interview for a position Friday after spending time teaching at Coralville Central Elementary School prior to coming to Solon. He is also studying to get into the administrative side of education. Quote, "That's kind of the path I see my career going down," he said, "so that was a big part of this decision," end quote. Lesson was a starting guard for Solon's 2006 Class 2A state tournament team and went on to play college basketball at Upper Iowa. He replaced Jason Pershing at Solon after Pershing left for an administrative job of his own at Mount Mercy University, his alma mater. Solon went 7-15 in a Murphy's Law type of 2019-20 season. The Spartans lost their best player, A.J. Coons, to a knee injury in the Class 3A state football semifinals. Solon dealt with a myriad of other injuries during the winter as well. The good news is 91.6% of the team's scoring returns next season, with good sophomore and freshman classes coming up. Whoever the new coach is will be getting a promising club. Quote, "This season was definitely a roller coaster of emotions," Lesson said. "Just being able to give back to the program that gave me so much was a dream come true for me. To be able to work with the amazing kids that are at Solon and a couple that with the coaching staff that I was somehow able to throw together, I mean, it was second to none. I'm so incredibly grateful for my kids and coaching staff because I could not have asked for a better group of people to work with," end quote. In other local sports news, Tony Paoli steps down as Cedar Rapids Rough Riders high school hockey coach. Tony Paoli announced Thursday that he is stepping down after 4 years as head coach of the Cedar Rapids Rough Riders high school hockey team. Paoli did amazing work, taking over a program that had a 0-28 record and taking it to the championship game of the Midwest High School Hockey League tournament 2 years in a row. Quote, "The past 4 years have been some of the best times I have ever had in my hockey career," Paoli said in a press release. "Watching the boys grow, not only as hockey players, but as young men, has been the most rewarding piece for me," end quote. Quote, "On behalf of the entire Rough Rider family, thank you for all you have done for the program and the young men you have coached," said Ken Brown, president of the Rough Riders Hockey Club. "You have helped make the high school Rough Riders a group of which we can all be proud," end quote. Rough Riders Hockey Club Executive Director Dustin Tim will take over the high school team on an interim basis, leading summer off-season conditioning until a new head coach is found. And KJ Pilcher of the Gazette reports, Iowa high school wrestling programs will have option to sit out regional duels competition. The Iowa High School Wrestling State Duels Tournament isn't going anywhere. The event is remaining at Wells Fargo Arena, taking place the day before the 3-day traditional state tournament. Qualifying and the teams involved could be different. The Iowa High School Athletic Association Board of Control unanimously approved recommendations from its Wrestling Advisory Committee in April, allowing teams to opt out of postseason duels before the start of regular season competition and trimming the regional duels field from 32 to 24 classes in classes 1A and 2A. The changes go into effect for the 2021 season. The goal is to create a better competitive environment for regional duels. Quote, "The hope is that the regional duels and state duels is that teams that show up are going to bring their best varsity kids, being able to compete and try to win," IHSAA Wrestling Administrator and Director of Officials Louis Curtis said. Quote, "We've had numerous situations where teams basically send their junior varsity or non-district qualifiers and those beat out at sectionals. They're just not sending their best team. They don't want to advance, but they qualified because they won or got second at their sectional. We're just trying to give them the option of not being there if they don't want to be there," end quote. The process will begin before the start of the season. Wrestling programs will receive a survey about their plans to participate. Teams can choose to be removed from consideration at that time, and decisions are final. Those teams will not be included in dual rankings by the Iowa Wrestling Coaches and Officials Association, which will be used to round out the regional duels field. Participants in 1A and 2A will be the 16 sectional champions and the next 8 ranked teams. If one of the sectional champions decline to wrestle in duels, the next highest ranked team will take its place. Quote, "I think it is positive," West Delaware coach Jeff Foss said. "If you have a highly ranked team and you don't want to be there, you're taking an opportunity away from somebody who does." The reasoning was the regionals were becoming so lopsided because the teams don't necessarily want to be there. So they'll take 24 teams and hopefully those 24 teams want to be there, end quote. Class 3A regional duels will continue to consist of the top 24 ranked dual teams. Last season, regional dual semifinals included 4 shutouts and a forfeit. In 16 1A regional duels, the average margin of victory was a whopping 37.6 points, which grew to 42.7 in the 7 competed in 3A. Fort Madison forfeited to Cedar Rapids Kennedy at North Scott. In 2A, the gap was slightly smaller at 31.75. Cedar Rapids Prairie romped Pleasant Valley in its regional duel opener. Despite being outmatched by 4th-ranked Bettendorf, the Hawks made moves and an effort to knock off the Bulldogs. Quote, "My hope is that the regional dual final is 2 teams really attempting to get to that state duels," Prairie coach Kane Thompson said. "If you didn't want to get it to it, you could have been out a long time ago. I think those duels will be more competitive," end quote. Linmar coach Doug Stryker said the changes will have little effect on the problems caused by the timing of the regional duel and state duels being placed before the individual qualifier and state tournaments. Quote, "I don't think it does much," Stryker said. "It doesn't solve any of the problems we have in our sport with duels the way they are. Zero impact," end quote. Stryker also said he feels the coaches shouldn't be involved in rankings, the pairings, and hosts, preferring it done by a neutral party that oversees the sport. He also noted the timing of the survey makes it hard for coaches to make an appropriate decision. Quote, they have bigger fish to fry than teams opting out in November, Stryker said. To me, it makes no sense whatsoever. They, the coaches, have no idea what kind of team they're going to have at the end of the season, where they're going for regionals, what teams there are, what their injuries are like, or what their lineup looks like. End quote. Stryker was asked about how he will approach the Lions' decision. Quote, I'm not closing any doors in November, Stryker said. Let's put it that way. End quote. Thompson has discussed the situation already with his staff. He plans to have the Hawks in the mix each year. Quote, no matter what, we're going to be all in, Thompson said. I think that's the message we send to our kids. I want to try to win what's available out there. If that's available, then I want to keep it on our radar and part of our goals. End quote. And turning to business, correspondent George C. Ford has written an article titled, Ready to Reopen? 4 Cedar Rapids Business Leaders Offer Advice. On Wednesday, Governor Kim Reynolds removed some restrictions on businesses in the 22 counties that have been seeing higher numbers of Iowans affected by COVID-19, including Linn and Johnson counties. Now those organizations have to make decisions on bringing back employees, services to provide, and how much access to allow for customers. And as those businesses reopen, some after more than 2 months, crucial steps likely will include ongoing communication with employees and customers and a well-thought-out restart plan. The Gazette spoke with business leaders about the challenges faced by business owners as they consider how and when to open their doors. David Drulow of Action Coach Heartland in Cedar Rapids is a consultant with 19 years of business coaching experience. David Hensley, director of the University of Iowa's John Papajohn Entrepreneurial Center, has expertise in small business management during a crisis. Josh Siemens is vice president of Cushman & Wakefield, a global commercial real estate advisor that operates offices in more than 60 countries, including China. And Steve Shrivers is a Cedar Rapids entrepreneur who operates and or helped found 4 diverse enterprises, including Ecolips and Bruhemia. Their responses here have been condensed from lengthy individual interviews. Let's begin with the question, how important is communication and having a well-prepared plan for resumption of business? Shriver says the one thing that has been imperative throughout this whole process is communication with employees, customers, and the public. I also would recommend writing as detailed a business resumption plan as possible. One of the main reasons is to fully understand what you are doing, as this is a brand new challenge that none of us has faced. Drulow adds, you really need to be communicating now more than ever with your employees, customers, vendors, and suppliers. What does your plan for the next 20 to 30 days look like? What are things that you can be doing right now to get ready? Hensley adds, I think it is critically important to have a reopening plan because most businesses are not going to be at full strength right away. What might their revenue forecasts look like? How can they keep their costs down as their businesses start to rebound before it gets back to full capacity? Siemens adds, your plan should include a checklist of reopening steps appropriate to your type of business. Retail will have different items than distribution or industrial businesses. You need to communicate your plan to employees, customers, landlords, and lenders. The next question is, how much will fear play a role in the resumption of business? According to Shriver, everyone has a different idea of the risks involved, such as using a handle to open a door or interacting with a person, the little things that we are used to doing. When you look at the risk versus reward of doing that, some people will be willing to go into a store and others will stay home. Some employees don't want to come back to work yet, and some people are itching to get back. You have everything in between. Drulow adds, the fear factor is huge. For the small business owner, we try to channel that fear into a focus on being highly aware of all the possibilities to mitigate concerns. If you own a restaurant, can you post the menu online or use disposable menus? That way, a customer doesn't have to touch something that might have been handled by someone else. Appropriate spacing of customers within a restaurant also will help alleviate some of the fear. Hensley adds, you need to communicate what steps you are taking to protect the health and safety of your employees and your customers. If you will be requiring the use of personal protective equipment like face masks, are you going to make them available? Will limiting the number of people entering a business be difficult? According to Shriver, there are not a lot of people who want to gather in masses right now. It seems like as businesses start to reopen, it will be more like a trickle. It will be just like turning on a water spigot with the flow of customers gradually increasing. And turning to political and coronavirus news, James Q. Lynch of the Gazette reports, ahead of Vice President Pence's Iowa visit, Joe Biden's campaign calls out a so-called consequential failure of Trump coronavirus response. Vice President Mike Pence owes Iowans more than a photo op when he visits Des Moines today, according to Joe Biden's campaign. Quote, Iowans are seeing up close the most consequential failure of government in modern American history, said Kate Bedingfield, spokeswoman for the former vice president and presumptive Democratic presidential nominee. Quote, with nearly 300,000 Iowans filing for unemployment, rural hospitals on life support, Latino communities disproportionately suffering, and workers on the job without sufficient protection, Mike Pence owes Iowans more than a photo op. He owes them answers, she said. Pence, head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, is scheduled to meet with Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, all Republicans, as well as with faith, farm, and food production leaders. Pence will talk to faith leaders about how they are using federal and state guidelines to open their houses of worship in a safe and responsible manner. Later, he will go to Hy-Vee's headquarters in West Des Moines for a roundtable discussion with agriculture and food supply leaders to discuss steps being taken to ensure the food supply remains secure. Pence has called Iowa a so-called success story in its response to the COVID-19, but Bedingfield said the Trump administration failed to protect Iowa families from the virus that has claimed the lives of 231 Iowans. Quote, from devastating losses across the state at meatpacking plants to rural communities, one thing is clear. It's Iowans and the American people who are paying the price for the Trump administration's denials and delays in response to this pandemic, she said. Quote, instead of listening to our own intelligence agencies and public health experts, Donald Trump was fed dangerous propaganda from the Chinese Communist Party, and he bought it, she said. Iowans deserve better. They deserve Joe Biden, end quote. For his part, Grassley said he welcomes the discussion with Pence. Quote, there's much work to be done, and the pandemic is disrupting all of our communities, Grassley said. It's important to hear directly from those who help feed the nation and the world, end quote. Ernst also is looking forward to the discussion of how Iowa is working to protect the health and safety of Iowa's families and communities while reopening the state's economy. Quote, we continue to take an all-hands-on-deck approach to tackling this pandemic, she said. Together, we will get through this, end quote. And turning to today's living section in the Gazette, Kylie Alger's Commit to Be Fit column is titled Shower Mom with Love from a Distance. Mother's Day celebrations will look different for many families this year as we follow social distancing guidelines. Fortunately, we don't have to be in proximity to express our love and appreciation. One of our core human desires is to feel appreciated. Looking for ideas to express your gratitude to mom? Try one of these ideas to make the special women in your life feel appreciated this Mother's Day. Walk and talk. Exercise has the power to boost energy, decrease stress, increase sleep quality, and improve confidence and strength. If possible, go on a social distancing walk with your mom instead this weekend. Give her a gift certificate for new sneakers, bicycle, treadmill, resistance bands, or dumbbells for her home gym, or a pretty water bottle to keep her hydrated. How about a virtual date? Thank goodness for technology. FaceTime, Zoom, and Skype are just a few ways you can virtually connect and celebrate mom. If you live in town, you could drop off her favorite coffee, breakfast items, and flowers. Another option is a video message. Have family members send you a short video message saying what they love about your mom or grandma. Compile all the videos using iMovie on your iPhone or another video app. She will love watching the special montage again and again. You can also organize pictures. Do you have a lot of great family photos collecting dust on your phone or computer? Make a photo book for Mother's Day. Walgreens has a speedy same-day photo book you can create. And what about gardening? Gardening is a wonderful way to get a healthy dose of vitamin D and enjoy the outdoors. Gardening is also great exercise and is tremendous for mental and emotional health. Support mom's healthy hobby with a garden pad to kneel on, garden gloves, a sun hat, non-toxic sunscreen, a planter, flowers, a pretty watering can, or a gift card to a local greenhouse. And for the bookworm? Reading helps improve brain function, memory retention, stimulates creativity, and feeds emotional intelligence. Gift her a book light for night reading or a gift certificate to a local bookstore. Purchase a pretty bookmark, or better yet, make your own bookmark and write down things you love about her. Simple and something she will cherish every time she reads. What about writing a letter? Never underestimate the power of a thoughtful handwritten card. My mom always tells us kids that a nice letter means more to her than anything we could buy her. Share the top 10 things you appreciate about your mom, wife, grandmother, mother-in-law, friend, or daughter with children. It's free, and I guarantee it will be one of the best gifts she will receive this Mother's Day. And finally, start a new ritual. Mother's Day may not be a joyful day for everyone. If your mother is no longer living, how can you feel especially close to her this weekend? Try lighting a prayer candle, read one of her favorite books, look back on favorite pictures, and reminisce about the many special days and memories you shared together. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May the 8th, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Caresi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. With half a dozen measles outbreaks currently underway in the U.S., as well as several serious international outbreaks, the news on measles vaccine from Denmark is important. Researchers conducted a nationwide study that included everyone born between 1999 and 2010. With more than 650,000 children in that group, they had more than 5 million person-years of follow-up. The Danish health system keeps excellent records on all of its citizens, including the children. Consequently, the scientists are confident that the 6,517 children diagnosed with autism during the study period are all the children who developed this condition. Children who did not receive the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or MMR, were equally likely as vaccinated children to develop autism. The investigators conclude, the study strongly supports that MMR vaccination does not increase the risk for autism, does not trigger autism in susceptible children, and is not associated with clustering of autism cases after vaccination.
The Food and Drug Administration has just approved a completely new type of antidepressant. The nasal spray, called esketamine, is expected to help people who have not responded to standard antidepressants. It will be marketed under the brand name Spravato. This drug is chemically related to the injectable anesthetic ketamine that's been on the market since 1970 and is available generically. Although S-ketamine is administered as a nasal spray, people will not be permitted to purchase it for home use. They will need to use Spravato under medical supervision at a clinic or doctor's office. Some experts have challenged the FDA's approval process for S-ketamine. While two clinical trials demonstrated some benefit, two others did not show that S-ketamine is better than placebo. Side effects of this novel antidepressant include nausea, dizziness, headache, and a feeling of dissociation.
FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb unexpectedly announced his departure from the agency this week. Experts were puzzled by his announcement since he has received high marks from the administration, industry, and even some consumer groups. Dr. Gottlieb has raised questions about teen vaping and has been an outspoken critic of pharmacy chains that sell tobacco products to minors. Some commentators speculate that these stances might be related to his abrupt departure. His explanation for the sudden departure is that he wants to spend more time with his wife and young children. Dr. Gottlieb is a survivor of Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Another week, another drug recall. Many lots of ARB blood pressure drugs, including Losartan, Valsartan, and Irbesartan, have been recalled over the past 8 months. These medicines were contaminated with potential carcinogens known as NDMA and NDEA. Now, Hetero Labs has recalled 87 lots, and Tarrant Pharmaceuticals Limited is recalling 100 lots of Losartan tablets. These pills contain an entirely new contaminant just identified as NMBA. It, too, is a suspected carcinogen. All three of these nitrosamine contaminants are apparently created as a result of the manufacturing process. FDA Commissioner Gottlieb stated, "We're making important strides at understanding how these impurities form, and we're continuing to examine if nitrosamine impurities may also arise during the manufacture of other ARB drug products. The FDA is committed to implementing measures to prevent the formation of these impurities during drug manufacturing processes in the future."
Cocoa flavonoids may have some benefit for people with multiple sclerosis, according to a small study. Previous research showed that dark chocolate rich in cocoa compounds might improve symptoms of chronic fatigue. The investigators recruited 40 people with relapsing remitting MS to drink cocoa every day for 6 weeks. 19 of them got high flavonoid cocoa, while 21 drank low flavonoid cocoa. At the end of the study, those on the high flavonoid cocoa had slightly less fatigue and could walk somewhat farther in 6 minutes than they had at the outset. They also reported less pain. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.